Thank you, Charles. It is nice to be back in town. So, there was a lot that happened in Uganda over 2 weeks, and still stuff I'm trying to process and figure out inside my own heart. So I'll just give you a few brief things this morning, and I'm sure there'll be more that will come kind of as we go along. Maybe just to share with you is a briefest summary ever, Uganda is hard. It's hard to get there. It's hard to get all the way back into the bush. It's hard to be away from your family. It's hard when you don't even really have a good way to connect to them, and sometimes power's out, et cetera, and you go a couple days without a way to check in. It's not easy to live there for someone who's been raised in the West at all. Not really a comfortable kind of place to be. And it is, it was hard work. I taught over 50 hours when I was there and did tons of hours of counseling of pastors beyond that. And then by the time I got home every night, I had hours of prep work to be ready for teaching the next day. So I just worked the entire time. But I will tell you that there were 65 Ugandan pastors and church leaders that worked just as hard as I did, that were there that whole way through. There were a couple pastors that came that were from a Pentecostal background, which is what most of those in Uganda are. They don't really know much about Lutherans, and so they actually showed up the first day or two because they just wanted to show how wrong Lutherans were, because they pretty much knew that no one but Pentecostals were going to go to heaven. So they were just going to show how messed up we were, and then they'd be free to go about the rest of their stuff. And they stayed the whole 2 weeks. And they said at the end, I never would have imagined I would have gone to any conference for 2 weeks, that I could have left my ministry and whatever else, but they said there was no better use of my time than to be there sitting and learning. I was really amazed because these individuals, men and women, came and sat for over 7 hours of teaching day after day after day. And if you've ever just sat and been taught, like, that's hard. But over half of them came an hour early every day so that they could quiz each other and they could refresh and relearn what they had said the day before until they had it in their minds. And they were just teaching each other and learning and correcting each other. And I was just blown away that they were that committed to come early and make sure that this wasn't just something they wrote down on a page of notes, but something they really carried in their hearts. When I finished, they acknowledged that it is expensive for me to go over there. It cost thousands to get me there and let me live there for 2 weeks. But they said that if you had just wrote us a check, we would have missed out on so much. This is so much more valuable. There are about 40 churches in Uganda now. Thousands of people that are gathering and worship there that now have pastors that have a sense of the Bible. When I showed up there, 2 out of the whole group had even read the entire Bible. And they're functioning as pastors. I mean, they're doing the best they can. But it was transformative for them to really understand the whole scope of the Bible, what it's about, how do we interpret it, how do we use it, how do we begin to implement it in our lives, how do we begin to preach out of it. So just really transformative. So I just want to thank the 150 of you that said that you were going to pray. There were people almost every day that were fasting over that experience. It was incredibly difficult to take stuff I have taught in a Western mindset to teach people in Uganda, many of whom have never gone to class at all, never been a day in school. So just don't even have the foundation that so many of us have. So the success from that and the impact on their lives is primarily the work of God. And I really want you to see that. So that I just give my thanks to you for letting me be a part of that, for you supporting. And I knew every day I stood up to teach that I was surrounded by such a great family, by so many people supporting me, caring for my family here and blessing me in prayer there too. So I just have the deepest thanks. They have the deepest thanks for you, an appreciation for that opportunity for them to learn. So I just really am I'm appreciative of the ways you've been supporting me and what God was able to do. So thank you for that. We'll turn our attention now to the sermon that we have for today. We're going to be looking at a book from the Old Testament called Haggai, which maybe you haven't ever read, which is too bad. It's a great little book. It's located kind of on our Bible timeline well after they've lost all of their land and all of their possessions and been sent into exile under the Babylonians. 70 years later, God graciously forgives and allows them to return to their land with the idea that they're going to build the temple. It's not going to be as good as the first temple or as big, but it's going to be the temple they have. Haggai over here comes in about 90 years after they've made their way back. And the setting is one that will probably strike you a lot as kind of the American church, right? So here are a group of Bible-believing people, at least the Bible that they had, and they are faithful to that. They believe it firmly. They gather on a regular basis to teach from the Bible. They want the Bible to be lived out. They believe that God is the God above all gods. They want him to be honored. They want him to be celebrated in every way. They're basically good people. There's no huge outbreaks of immorality or violence or cruelty or lust or whatever else around them. I mean, they're kind of charting on the path that everyone would want them to be on, kind of doing all the right things. And then Haggai comes along, called by God to bring a challenge of judgment over them, which is a little confusing because if you look on the surface, they're checking all of the right spiritual boxes, right? At the first blush, you look at them like they're, out of anybody in the world at that time, kind of marching on God's path and doing what God wants to do. And there's one phrase that occurs 5 times. Haggai is the second shortest book in the Old Testament, so it's not a terribly long one. And the one phrase occurs 5 different times in there. And Haggai invites the people of Israel to give careful thought to your ways. He says, I know if we just do the quick 10,000-foot overview, everything seems fine. But what I'm asking, Haggai says, is that you would stop and you would just look carefully inside. And so I'm going to ask that of you this morning too. That you would allow in this time of the message God's Spirit to do more than just kind of quick do a flyby over your life. Ah, things seem okay, great, thumbs up, let's move on. And just let the Spirit search deeply. Will you pray with me? God, there's probably a lot of reasons why we'd rather you just skimmed over the surface in our lives. But we just want to be faithful to what this prophet is saying. And want to give you the freedom, God, to look as deeply in our lives as you need to. We come just with open hearts. I pray, God, that in this message time, whatever is spoken out of me would just flow past our ears, wouldn't stick anywhere. But whatever is truly of your Spirit, that it would find a place of rest, God, and a place of rest and a deep place in our hearts. We pray that in your name. So as Haggai begins, he raises kind of this interesting question for them. This sense of the right timing of things. They believed that all the stuff God was up to that he wanted to do was all really, really good. They just weren't sure it was the right time for them. You know, they would say, of course we believe that everybody ought to hear about Jesus. Right? That's really, really valuable. But if you understood the way things were at work for me, you'd understand that, man, that's a really delicate place, and I don't want to lose my job. I don't want to have tension over that. So it's not really a good place or the right time for me to speak about my faith there. I understand that building God's kingdom and caring for the poor and all of that requires resources and money. Totally in favor of that, believe me. I want to be in a place where I can give more, but I can't give more right now because I've made all these other commitments. Things are a little tight for us. There's not a whole lot of space, right? I'm totally in favor of that. And once I get those things together and get a better foundation, I want to be somebody who gives more, just not the right time right now for me to engage in that. And I appreciate that you have identified talent and strength inside of me and think I might be a good fit for that role. But man, if you just knew my life right now, I'm so stressed and so busy, just going 1,000 different directions, right? I mean, it's just not a good time for me. I believe in the ministry. I'm glad somebody's going to do it. I so want it to happen. But it's just not the right time for me. And all of those statements that are exactly where the Jews are exactly where we are. And there's just the sense that, man, my heart is fully behind that. It's just not good timing, right? Except this is what the Jews have said for 90 years. God, we want to build the temple. I mean, it's going to be good. It's going to be to your glory, and everyone around is going to see the faithfulness of God and how he's redeemed us. It's going to be a good thing, just not the right time. We're trying to get settled, and we're raising kids, and that's busy, and the crops are coming in. I've got friends that are visiting from out of town, etc. Not a good time. For 90 years. Right? The excuse is out there for all of us. I'm so in favor of all these things that are happening. It's just not the right time for me. We struggle to find anybody to serve on our director's board. Almost nobody ever volunteers straight up for it. We have to run after them. And we go through 30 people and can't get anybody to say yes to a couple hours a month. We have nursery duty, which is us caring for our own children. And it's a rotating basis where it's maybe every other month you show up for an hour tacked onto a worship service you're already coming to anyway. And endlessly we're asking again and again, could you give an extra hour every other month to take care of your own kids? And it's just not the right time. Man, if you knew how my life was and how busy it is, just pulled a lot of different directions, right? I mean, we brought Story in because we wanted to invest in our youth. And we know that we've just got this vacancy among our junior high. And we need people. We need adults to step in with those kids and be present time after time after time and join them, modeling Christ for them. Every person in here would say amen to that ministry. I want it to happen. I want good things for those kids. But it's a bad time for me to do that. I don't have space in my life to commit to that. Whatever else it might be, it just isn't good timing for me. But I'm so in favor of what's going on. We've got 30 small groups that all have an opportunity to say, we want to take some of our time and not just study the Bible, but be engaged in working with a vulnerable family. One that's on the edge, they're in poverty, they're caught, they got so many bad habits and things going on in their life, and nobody is an ally around them, just walking with them. And we've got one small group that said, we have time. And a lot of others that say, it's such a great idea. I'm so glad somebody's going to do that, but it doesn't fit for where we are. And none of that am I raising so that you fill one of those individual gaps necessarily, but just so that you understand, that's us. Like, we think all those things are brilliant, great ideas, but it's a bad time for me right now. It's a bad time in where my life is. And God raises two challenges to this mindset. The first one that he raises is, hey, look, I get that there's other things, but you seem to have plenty of time to do everything else you want to in your life. And you seem to have plenty of money for whatever comforts and pleasures you pursue. He says, I'm pretty sure that in the course of your week, you've got hours spent in front of the TV or watching stuff on Netflix, or you're messing around on your tablet or your phone or whatever else, playing games or scrolling through cat videos online, whatever. It's not that there's not time. God says, can we just be clear? There's time. I gave you time. The time is there. It's not that there's not money. Everyone here has a little extra somewhere. There's a comfort or something else that you're investing in somewhere. It's not that that's not present. God says there is time and there is money. What's missing is the priority. right? So let's talk a little bit about shoes and socks. Can we do that for a moment? Right? We learn about this stuff at a super young age, right? Everybody knows about shoes. You learn how to tie them eventually, those kinds of things. And we learn about socks. And we know that they are made for each other, right? Right? They're like best friends. They hang out. They fit together all the time. But we shouldn't say that one of them is more important, right? They're kind of equal in their role. And so as long as you have both of them in your life, it doesn't really matter the order that you put them. Right? There's no priority that you can say, and it doesn't matter which one goes on first or how you go about that, because as long as you have them both, you're doing fine. Right? And so you often see people walk around like that. Does that look silly? No, it absolutely does. Because I guarantee none of you will do this later on today. Nobody's showing up on a first date looking like this. What is so obvious to us with shoes and socks is that even though they go together and they're both valuable, that one of them of necessity comes first. They are not interchangeable. And so when you look at your life, there is one that comes first. We think as long as I have God somewhere in my life, as long as I haven't forgotten him and I've got other stuff and, oh, I've got a little God space here somewhere, we think we're okay. But that is as goofy as we look on a spiritual level. When all of the angels look down at us, and they see us pursuing first the stuff of the earth, the things that fade, the things that are made out of dust. And then on a secondary level, making room for the one that made it all. And the one that is truly beautiful, that is before time and after time and larger than all of that. And we look just as foolish. Because we've taken creation and we put it up above a creator. And God calls us on it. He says, you've got time. You have money. What you lack is a priority in the right place. Don't let me be an aspect of your life, a part of your life. Let me be your life. And then God raises another challenge. Because he's not done. This is so important for him. And I'm going to let actually Dr. Phil share with you Haggai chapter 1 verse 6. Because he does it Texas style as good as Haggai did it. So how's that working for you? So God says, hey, if we back off my first statement that there's plenty of time and we just roll with whatever you're saying, like, hey, it's just not the right time for me, getting there eventually, I'll get to all those things. Then he says, hey, how about we then examine your life closely again and say, how does that work? Is it all coming together the way you hoped and thought it would be? Let's do an examination just of our country first, and then we can get closer to us, right? We live in America. Hands down, the richest, best well-off country the world has ever seen. I was just in Uganda, and I could just kind of testify that this place is cleaner and nicer and richer than anything else. So America is number one. Do you know that? You know what America's number one in? Depression. Can you wrap your mind around that? More stuff. More comfort. More ease. More entertainment than anywhere else. I'm in villages with people that have never seen TVs and never will their entire life. More depression than anywhere else in the world. America is also number one in anxiety. 20% on some kind of medication because we're so nervous and so stressed and so overwhelmed by life. Number one. Number seven in keeping marriages together. Well, number seven in the fact that they all fall apart in divorce. The primary human relationship any of us ever has. The one that ought to be the greatest investment of our lives. And number seven in the world and having those things collapse. And when they collapse, it doesn't just hurt two people. There's ripple effects all around on top of that. We live in America. 25% of Americans acknowledge that they experience deep loneliness. They often feel very much alone. Boredom is unknown in most developing countries. I won't ask for a show of hands of parents that your kids so far in summer have already said, "I'm so bored." You didn't have to raise your hand, but I understand. This is what Haggai says. He says, "You planted so much and harvested next to nothing. Like you eat endlessly, but you're never satisfied. Drink all the time and you're never filled up. You put on clothes, you just can't get warm. You put money in a purse and it's like it's got a hole in the bottom and it goes out, right? We work endlessly, endlessly, endlessly. I just got to get a little bit more and then I'll be there. When are you ever there? Like, do you ever come to the point that you're like, I'm good, I'm satisfied, I'm content. No, a little bit more, a little bit more." But we see the same thing that Haggai says. That is not a description, understand this, of a nation that is blessed by God. That is a description of a nation that is cursed in the same way that Haggai said Israel was cursed. Cursed with futility. Cursed with emptiness. Cursed with dissatisfaction. This is not a God that wants those things for us. It's not a God that wants us to suffer like that. But he says when you flip the priorities, that's what occurs. When you say, I'm first and I got to find my own stuff and get my own life together, then I'll give extra to God, then there is no way to satisfaction. God is the one that made us. He made us to be satisfied. He made us to have joy and to have peace and to have fulfillment in our life. But he didn't make us so that we could have that apart from him. There is no pathway to fulfillment that exists apart from going through God. So if you want to tell yourself, oh man, once I just get my life together, then I'll finally be able to give. Once I finally get that together, I'll finally be able to serve. You are deluding yourself. Haggai gives us a solution. And it isn't a little bit more work, man, and you're finally there. Man, if I just had a little bit more money, if I got the lottery, not even the biggest, just a little one somewhere, I'd finally be able to do all this stuff. Man, if I might need some counseling that would help me figure that out, I need a little bit more me time, right? Just really stressed and so much going on. If I could just carve out some me time or get another vacation somewhere, I would finally be there. All of those are our solutions. Do you want to hear Haggai's? He says, obey. Just obey. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. And God will bring the other stuff along. He wants it for you. He does. He is an insanely good God who wants better stuff for you than you could ever imagine on your own. But he doesn't let you get there without him. He says, come and serve. Come and build the temple. Come and commit yourself into ministry, even when you don't know where the time is. Give, not because it's convenient, not because, oh, it's all extra, I could spare it. Give when you can't. Because there's a God that asks of that. Make him first. Make him the creator of everything. And see what he does afterward. Now, honestly, being a prophet in the Old Testament is one of the worst jobs you could ever imagine having. Most of these individuals spent their entire careers speaking God's truth endlessly and just being rejected and reviled and hated and made fun of, and nobody ever responds. Haggai is one of the few. One of the few. Where the people take the message to heart. And they do take careful thought about their own lives. And 23 days later, they began to build the temple. So I want to ask you, where will you be in 23 days? Will you have joyfully forgotten this entire message of Haggai and never think of that name again? Will you be back in the mode of saying like, oh, summer's almost over. I gotta get this in and this in and all these things packed in before the world starts rolling again and weather changes and everything else like that. I gotta pull all that together. Will you be still fitting in those last vacations and other plans or whatever else it is? Or in 23 days, will there have been a change? This is, God, I want to seek you first. And every day that I wake up is the day that is offered to you. Not a little bit here and there, not a couple hours a month. It's just all there. And you can begin to do whatever you want with my life. Where will you be in 23 days? Haggai invites us to think carefully, to consider deeply about our lives. And I want to just invite you to close your eyes right now and do that just one-on-one with the Holy Spirit. Don't need my words anymore, just need what he sees in you.